All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora.
Hey, it's Unpaid Bill. Check out this QLS classic from November 2nd, 2016. We sit down with recording artist Kimbra. She talks about being from New Zealand, the rural wildlife of Silver Lake, California, and how she makes records. This episode originally aired on Pandora. Check it out.
Kimbra Johnson, ladies and gentlemen. Now, before we even get started, we gotta know, how did you get such a black last name as Johnson? Wait, your full name is Kimberly.
Kimberly Lee Johnson. That's even,
she's kind of from like Nashville or something.
Yeah. Kimberly Johnson.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I feel like you come from the wrong side of the tracks.
Yeah.
I mean, I only realized that when I moved over here. I'm from New Zealand, obviously. And
aren't you from Hamilton, New Zealand?
How did you know that?
Because I have a computer. How do I know anything?
I thought you were just trying to bring it back to Hamilton.
I read that. I was like, that's funny. That's funny.
Hamilton's not the most well-known place in New Zealand, but
I can't say I've been there and or know if I could locate it.
Can I ask, do you get tired of people kind of lumping? I feel like New Zealand is the Jersey to New York or the Baltimore to Washington.
Right.
Kind of. I mean, I know it's cool, but
Yeah, but you know,
people over here just tend to think like it's one big giant down under Australia experience.
Totally.
Kangaroos.
There's only, you know, there's 4 million people in New Zealand. It's tiny, you know, so I understand. And I spent 5 years in Australia. I moved there when I was 17 before I came to the States. So I understand it's, you know.
How long have you been in the States? How long have you been here?
Ooh, over 3 years now. I did LA for nearly 2 years, and then I'm about a year into living in New York.
Wow. What's been the biggest adjustment for you so far?
Oh, man. I'm so happy here. I love walking and getting on the subway and taking, like, just simple things like that that change your experience of a city so much. You know, I was always in the back of Ubers in L.A. I didn't have a car. So I'm just loving. I live, like, in the East Village. There's so much history there as well. So many amazing people that have lived in that area. So
wait, you didn't drive in L.A.? But
I know, right?
You drive in New York City?
I don't drive in New York, no.
Oh, okay.
I have a full driver's license, but I just never got in the car over here. I mean, we drive on the other side of the road, so it would be challenging, you know.
Wait, so you don't drive here?
I don't drive.
Wait a minute.
In America.
The first time we met, I made you like a 400-song driving playlist.
Yeah, but that was different. That was.
Wait, but.
Yeah, you made me a sick playlist for the road trip, but I did that with a friend.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Did I make you a road trip playlist for no reason whatsoever?
I was just going to Brooklyn.
For an Uber ride?
I see. I guess we would all like to know about your humble beginnings.
Sure.
One, you have a wise soul for someone that is 4 months younger than A Tribe Called Quest's debut album. Every time I see your birth year, I'm like, I was a freshman in college when you were born. But you seem to acquire a lot more knowledge than most people that I know that have a 9 in the third year of their birth year, as far as music's concerned.
Thanks, man.
And without the, really the development of the internet being in full swing until 10 years later, like, what were your first formative years like that really has you curious about soul music of all things?
Yeah, you know, Stevie Wonder was really big for me. I first started learning guitar when I was about 13, 14. Guitar's my first instrument. That's what I first started writing on. And learning a lot of those inversions and stuff on guitar was super inspiring, you know, for opening my brain harmonically. And I was singing in a little choir at school that were doing a lot of Beach Boys covers, you know, and Sinatra. And this is like trippy stuff for a kid who's been, you know, I also had all my R&B stuff that I was listening to on the radio, Destiny's Child and all the Timbaland era, you know. But then I was learning about these other styles of music. And I first got into a Boss 8-track. That's how I started all my early recordings, all the first albums. So then the kind of producer had started lighting up, you know, and getting excited about listening to records in the sense of dimension. And it's just, it's like the same as you, man. You know, starting one artist and, I mean, Prince, for example. And it takes you on such a journey and you just get super curious. I was a sponge when I was a kid.
What keeps you from being so dismissive? Because even, I mean, for whatever nerd degree I have of music, I mean, I definitely went through that period where, like, you know, when I was 6 or 7, Marvin Gaye comes on, I'm just thinking, like, that's my aunt's music.
Yeah, right. You know. That's something that I'm impressed by being young.
Like, what kept you from being dismissive?
That's right, or cynical even, you know, because when you hit your teens, you start to be, like, quite niche with what you like. But I always had quite an openness, which I see as a gift, I guess. I was very intrigued by metal music, for example, like, you know, bands from New Jersey like the Dillinger Escape Plan and Meshuggah, you know, for the grooves. Something about just from a really open standpoint of what at the time, like, what makes me feel so primally engaged to these rhythms, and then learning that a lot of it comes from Latin, you know, it's like you just become so fascinated with stuff. And it didn't ever come across my mind like, oh, that's cool and that's not cool and that's what my friends like and that's what they don't. It was just all sound, you know. And I don't think we retain that openness sometimes as we get older. We get a bit more, you know, into aesthetics and into taste, and that's great. All of that's really cool. But as a kid, I'm glad I had that openness.
So you started songwriting. I know that you were songwriting by, well, you said your first instrument was,
well,
when you were
13, I was writing just in, you know, singing into cassette tapes when I was like 8 or 9, just little silly songs, but they had structure, you know, verses and choruses. I love pop music as a formula for writing.
Would that come from your family or like?
They're doctor and nurses, so I don't know, man.
Who's that older? Who's the older brother figure? No,
I don't know. I think it was just, I really talk about it almost more in a spiritual sense because it's like something needs to come out, you know, when you have a need to express. And at that time, I was asking questions. I was curious, you know, and this became a language. Melody was very intriguing. Lyrics were a way of like, yeah, just expression. And then learning an instrument, of course, everything changes because you can start to really get deeper with the art form.
Was there ever a moment where you realized that you could write songs? Like, did you realize, like, all right, I might can pay a bill off of this?
Well, I'll tell you something about New Zealand that's really special is we have this competition. It's a high school band competition called the Rock Quest. And it's not televised or anything. It's not like American Idol or anything like that. It's kids and bands, you know? So kids literally stay in high school to enter this competition. It's super important for kids at school. And so I entered this competition as a soloist, just on guitar, you know, playing songs from my bedroom that I thought were just for me. And I ended up being like the only girl in the finals and coming second in the whole country, which for New Zealand was a big deal, you know. So at that point, it's probably the same for you. You have those moments, you go, okay, this is not only something that makes me really happy in my bedroom, but wow, people seem to be engaged with it. I'm being acknowledged for it, and maybe I can develop it more.
And they were fully realized, fully arranged songs?
Yeah, they were. I was about 14 at the time when that happened. And then later got signed at like 17. So from those ages, I was developing songs in the studio, learning how to record on an 8-track. So the songs moved from being less guitar-based and more recording the entire arrangement on vocals. And that was really inspiring to me, you know, fleshing out the drum beat, just beatboxing, or just little silly ideas. But that became Settled Down, you know, a song I wrote when I was 16, which is probably the song that broke me first here in America before the Gautier stuff.
Wow. Is Val's your debut
that
album?
That was the debut, yeah.
So yeah. How does your debut album feel in contrast to what you're working on now as far as...
Yeah, well,
I always feel like you're working all your life on your first record.
That's true. Well, and 3.5 years.
Artists wind up like separating themselves from their debut record once they grow and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm 26 now. That record came out when I was 21. I started making it when I was about 18, you know, and the songs are those ones from your bedroom, you know, that you've lived with all your life. And like you said, now it's like it's third album time for me. So, you know, new city, new experiences, everything's changed. The second album, The Golden Echo, for me was kind of, that was a very experimental time for me, you know, moving to LA and so much. Yeah, you're always drawing from where you're at. But the first, you're right, there's something like listening to it now, you kind of look at it like it's a young child you had, or someone you do, you know, you knew, but it's a strange connection that you have
someone
with your
that
debut.
You used to know.
Okay, it was coming.
You know, I was actually trying to let the whole entire segment go by without even mentioning that.
Too late.
Yeah. So
does it feel like a burden that you know? Do you feel as though that's not a burden, but it's sort of like an asterisk on your career that mainly people might only know you for that.
Yeah, that's understandable. I mean, yeah.
The full spectrum of your... Well, how did that collaboration come to be? Like,
so organic. It's kind of because I was making Vows, and the main producer I worked with on the album was called Francois Titez, and I knew his work because he produced the first Gautier record, and I was in love with it. You know, I was like, this is super prog pop. I was so into it, and I was like, I want to work with the guy that made that album. And so he introduced me and Wally, so we just became friends, and we didn't talk for a good year after we met. And then he just called me up one day. He's like, I've got this song, you know, I'm looking for, you know, the other character in the song, and can I come over this afternoon and show you it and see if you'd be down to sing it? And just came over. I had a little home bedroom studio, and it's just so organic, the whole thing. The video is like never any notion that this was going to be what it was.
Yeah, I was going to say, how long did it take you guys to shoot that as far as the editing
was
concerned?
That was the longest, most grueling video shoot I've ever done in my life. No question. That was, I mean...
Was it days or...
It was
it all
full,
stop motion?
Yeah, so we didn't move for, you know, it was like we took toilet breaks, but it was a good 14 hours in that position. With, you know, sort of strategic breaks and then back in and just being fed nuts while we, because it's six, you know, six or seven photographs and then a second of, you know, sorry, six or seven seconds in a photograph, then 6 or 7 seconds, then a photograph, then, you know what I mean? You see the process?
Okay.
Yeah. It was it was a long day.
That was amazing. Of course, you had no idea that, you know, that would lead to...
Well, would you? I mean, the song is not like what you would hear on the radio, and it's kind of...
Yet it is.
Right. Yeah, well, you'd know more than me, man. I did not see that coming.
Well, that's amazing. That's...
But I'm here. It's cool.
I'm glad you didn't see that coming. So why did you leave? I mean, what was the...
Yeah.
What was the community vibe like in... Okay, I'm one of those people that will love
it's okay.
Australia
it's okay,
and
yeah.
New Zealand with each other.
Have you been to New Zealand?
You don't have to stand for that.
Yeah.
You don't have to stand for that.
You've been a bunch of times.
The
okay.
first time?
No,
wait, you trying to start a tour for right now, Bill?
I get it, but the thing that you need to understand is...
What's the difference?
There's a big difference.
Tell me the difference.
Well, first off, we do have very different accents. Mine is all over the place these days. But if you go to New Zealand and then Australia, you'll hear very significant... Should we do the obvious one? Australians say fish and chips. New Zealanders say fish and chips. It's a lot more blunt. It's a lot more... The eye's very different. that's New Zealand 101. New Zealand versus Australia 101.
I didn't know that. That's awesome. That's the word. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, so that's a good one. It's a good starting place if you give a go back.
Again, it's like...
Fish and chips, mate.
Jersey, New Yorkers and New Jerseyans always battle with their turf, and D.C. and Maryland battle with their turf.
Yeah, right.
Font, is there a South North Carolina turf war going on?
South Carolina, North Carolina, kind of, sort of. I mean, North Carolina, well, first off, like, when people speak of the Carolinas, in North Carolina, we really just count ourselves. Like, South Carolina is like its own separate thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so, in North Carolina, our leading export, other than basketball, is racism. And so, you know what I mean? So, you know, we pride ourselves on that. And
on the finest top shelf racism.
I mean, only the finest. I mean, it has been aged in oak barrels for centuries.
Like whiskey.
Oh, man, come on. So yeah, it is kind of like that. North Carolina and South Carolina don't really rock like that. In North Carolina, Charlotte is like the capital. Well, no, I'm sorry. Charlotte is the biggest city. That's where all the banks are. So Charlotte is like kind of, they think they're
progressive.
They think they are, but they're really not.
Cosmopolitan.
Yeah, kind of cosmopolitan. Yeah, because it's like they kind of want to be Atlanta. So they're like in Atlanta on the cusp. You know what I mean? Like right. They trying to get there. But it's like, you know, it's like Atlanta is the Bentley and Charlotte is like the 300 Chrysler.
Ooh.
You know what I mean? It's like, it looked like a Bentley until a real Bentley pull up.
And then is this the same with, I mean, who would have the upper hand between New Zealand and Australia?
Ooh.
Culturally, as you.
The upper hand in terms of. Now this is, what are we talking?
I don't want you to throw any of your places under the bus, but I'm just saying.
Yeah. Oh, look, they, you know, like the landscape of the two countries are chalk and cheese, really. Yeah, I really have to go there and experience it because they've both got so much to offer and they've both been a huge part of my journey. You know, I lived in Melbourne for 5 years, made vows there, and New Zealand's my home. That's where I grew up. That's where I go home every Christmas to see my family. So they're both important places. And America's a really important place now for me. This New York's a home for me now. You know, it's amazing here.
Was it hard for you to leave there? Or did you have to come to America just so that your music career could?
I think it's like, I like the idea of continuing to move forward and having your experiences inform your art, you know, and I'd made a record there. I felt like I'd taken a lot of experience from the place and I just signed to Warner Brothers in LA and it felt like, yeah, let's do it, you know, a new experience, a new record. And then same thing with this one's third album and I've gotten up and planted in a new city again. Something about that feels natural to me.
I see. So in LA, you mentioned, I know that you've cross paths with what I call the Animaniacs of Soul.
Yeah.
Like whenever I think of Thundercat or when I think of Lotus, the way that they run, that Tasmanian devil, like swirl of wind running in that Warner Brothers tower. Like,
yeah, that's true.
That's how I think of that movement. I mean, yeah. You can get.
What are you talking about?
Yeah. No, I was just thinking of, you know.
Thundercat worked a lot on the last album. Yeah, he became, yeah, it's, and again, man, all of these connections have been so organic. It's even how I kind of met you. It was just a mutual, like, you know.
Well, I kind of stalked you on Twitter. So.
Oh, I mean, I've been stalking you. I just didn't put it on public, you know.
Oh, wow.
But,
was you in the DM, though?
I wasn't in the DM.
Did it go down in the DM?
I wasn't in the DM. I kept it out.
Can we play that? Can you cue up your guy. He's down in the DM. Get that out.
No, I kept it out in the open. I saw her. This is, I first saw her on Leno.
Yeah, that's right.
And usually the music act is the very last segment before the show changes. And we were, this is obviously in the early part of Late Night with Jimmy Fallon because I was still running home to watch the show afterwards.
Oh, wow.
Well, I mean, after like a year, then that wore off. Then I stopped. But I'm just saying that when she was on, like, I was amazed. And, you know, then I stalked her on Twitter. And then.
I'm glad you did.
And
man.
Now she's here.
Now we're here.
Hey, sometimes the stalker wins. That is the lesson of today. Don't never let laws keep you from the woman you love. Never stop that. Come on.
Views expressed by Font. Sometimes the stalker wins. Bill, write that down.
I'm gonna write that down.
Yo,
it's important.
I just had a spit take. Someone give me it.
I'll get to see.
I gotta save my computer.
You just spit on your computer?
I did. I spit on my computer.
Oh, good job. Good job. Good job.
No, I don't love you, Kimbra. No, I mean, I admire you.
Oh, man. Wow.
Oh, wait a minute. Should have been a direct message. Should have gone direct. Should have taken that shit direct, because now it's real.
Now it's in the world.
No, in all seriousness, so organic relationships.
Yeah, just friends, you know, people that you meet out or at a gym or, you know, same way we did. And all of a sudden, I was living at a farm in L.A. It was very weird.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I had like eight sheep, man. Eight sheep. Good in the God. Backyard.
Wait,
yeah.
Los Angeles, California?
Yeah, this lady. I found it on Craigslist, and she had a little urban city farm at the back of her house in Silver Lake. Three sheepdogs, 20 chickens.
Wow.
So Thundercat, Steven would come over, and we would just hang out with the animals. And then he'd be like, play me what you're working on. And he'd be like, oh, I've got an idea. You know, press record. That's just how it started. We're just lying, like, outside with the animals, listening to tunes that I was working on. And
that sounds what? Horrible.
Isn't that what? Crazy?
Wait.
That sounds
hang
horrible.
On. Huh? I lived.
What?
It's wow. A rooster
lived,
woke me up.
I lived in Silver Lake for you. There was a farm in Silver Lake?
No one believes me.
I don't.
So I moved out of Silver Lake because the skunk used to chase me home.
Oh, wow.
No, like, if you weren't home at a certain hour, you know, wild animals just
that's
come
right.
out.
Well, check this out. Coyotes. Do you say coyotes?
Coyotes.
Coyotes. Coyotes came and ate six of the chickens, so we had to get three sheepdogs.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Oh, they were, like, tough, you know?
Oh, the sheepdogs would chase the
coyotes. They kept everyone safe, yeah.
Wow, you really did live on a farm.
Yeah, so it just started out hanging out at the farm, and then all of a sudden he was tracking ideas, and then he was like the bass, you know, sound of the last record. So it's very cool when things happen like that.
Very creative individual, that Thundercat.
Oh yeah, he's one of a kind.
I'm still stuck on farm animals.
Can we talk about the skunk chasing you? Because there's more. There's way more to be said about.
That's great.
I've got a mental image in my head of running away from a skunk.
Well, once,
yeah.
Okay, so like I would drive up a hill. If you know California streets, yeah. And like some of them are full of hills, and it's really dark there, and you know, I drive, and then you'd see. You know, their eyes, there's like three or four of them maybe in front of my door. And I didn't know what to do. So I thought, okay, this is a smart idea. Let me get back in the car and I'm going to approach them at like 50 miles per hour. Like I was in a zone of like maybe you should be doing 20. So I figured if I do 50, they'll run away. But what I didn't know was that in the face of fear, they spray you.
Kind of skunk 101.
Yeah, I know that now.
Right.
And literally, I got my entire, like, my bill for the car rental. They thought I had a lot. They're like, wait, we know you. You don't smoke weed. And I was like, this is skunks. And I explained, and they were like, yeah, you can't scare a skunk because they will spray you. My car and me never get sprayed by a skunk, let alone three of them.
That's why it's
good God.
Did you have to bathe in tomato sauce? Is that a true? Is that a true?
I didn't know about that.
They like to get the scent. The
well,
smell.
I tried to dismiss it, but then like, thank God for like weed culture because everyone just thought like I had the good shit.
I'm the plug.
but you always smell like a bakery. Did it smell like a skunk?
No, I was the opposite of a bakery. I smelled like I had that good.
You smell like somebody that was on his way to a bakery.
Yeah, right, exactly. Right. Like, yeah, there you go.
No, that was the worst. Like, that was Mischief Night. I don't know if people still celebrate that. That was like the night before Halloween. Not to mention, I got egged.
God.
The next night I got egged in Silver Lake.
Oh,
and so
wow.
It was a bad first week out there.
Whew.
Yeah, so that's my skunk story in Silver Lake.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonsigolo from Team Supreme. Black representation in media is very important to me. I think it's important to have our stories told by people who look like us and who have shared in our common experiences. Some of my earliest influences were Donnie Simpson. I would also say Tom Joyner, Angela Stribling, Sherry Carter. They were just people who told our stories with a lot of class and dignity and were big inspirations to me. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcast, The Center Black Voices. It's NPR Noir. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so right about now, you're working on your third album.
Mm-hmm.
And what is your vision or your... How do you even grow past the level experiments that you've been...
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to do new things, you know? The last record was like a maximalist album. I got to meet all these amazing people and kind of just invited them all down to the studio, you know? Why not? Which was super cool, but... I'm really enjoying, like, trying more of a directness with some of the beats that I'm writing and things that I'm, you know, doing as demos. They're a lot more to the point than I've ever been, which is exciting and probably comes with, like, age and maturity. You kind of start to turn more things off and you don't have to do as many flourishes to get emotion across, you know. I've had more experiences. I'm inspired by a lot of records at the moment. I've been spending a lot of time in Ethiopia the last couple of years.
I was going to say, your Instagram's kind of off the chain. You just came back from Ethiopia. What was that like?
It's just crazy, that place. It's gotten so under my skin. Like, I'm hoping to go back every year if I can. It's just that powerful. Not only the music and the food and the culture, but the people have really touched me. And that wasn't really doing gigs or anything. That was just more doing some kind of work, like more on a spirit tip, like spending time with the woman over there. A lot of them are HIV positive and kind of being a part of a team that does work over there. So that's been really cool. And I'm really into that balance, you know, of taking time completely off music. Have you ever done that, man? 17 projects. But then it's kind of like
I'm working now
thing,
as
you know?
We talk.
No, but it is like you are amazing at that, actually. You know, how you have your finger in all that of different, projects that are varied, you know?
Well, is this your version of you need to recharge before you start creating, so you have to take yourself out of music to...
Yeah, I think that's one way of looking at it, for sure. And just fill up with different yeah, ideas, experiences, and being, there's something very powerful about being completely anonymous in a place and not there to be a musician with all of your, that skill set of that, what that brings, but just to be a human being, you know, and observe and offer your heart and offer. So that's been really powerful, and I'm excited to now channel, you know, the rawness of some of those experiences into, you know, my next body of work.
Do you have, any artist, especially an artist on a major label, do you have any thoughts whatsoever about, you know, how far to the left you can lean as far as experimentations are concerned, and how far to the right you should go to make sure that it's easily digestible? Like, do you have those ongoing wars with your current A&R right now?
Of course. Like, I mean, of course. I think I ask that question to my other musician friends as well. It's like the answer is always the same. We're all trying to balance it. I'm lucky at Warner Brothers. We talked about this when we did the Prince panel. Like, Lenny Wanaker, like, has been with me from day one there. He's got amazing music.
He's still there?
He's still there?
Yeah. Wow. He's my main. I've been with him from day one.
Tell me some Lenny Wanaker
stories. He signed me to Warner Brothers. Oh, my gosh.
I did not know that Lenny Wanaker was still there.
Oh, yeah.
Even when we did that Prince panel.
Yeah. Lenny, I talked to him all the time.
Prince?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Mo Austin.
He signed a whole bunch of, like... James Taylor, didn't he?
Yeah, he produced Randy Newman records. Yeah. He did the Van Dyke Parks first record. I mean, this guy is an incredibly musical mind. I'll be showing him songs.
Do you have any special stories
about him? I mean, just think of how cool this is. Like, I'll be showing him, you know, you're expecting the A&R to tell you to make the chorus bigger, right? You know, right. It's a classic thing. Make it big. But he'll be like, well, I think in the third bar you could make it a little more harmonically complex. I mean, what if you put a seventh in there? You know, just, and he'll really talk to me in that sense of like, you know, it just needs a different contrast at that point. And this to me is very inspiring, you know, to be able to have those kinds of conversations.
Yeah, A&R guy can talk music in that way. Amazing.
Well, being
that would
lucky,
throw me off. I wouldn't trust that situation.
I mean,
for a writer credit.
But at the same time, I've had my battles, of course, you know, and I continue to. And that's kind of, I think... the tension that's kind of needs to be there as well. In a sense, it pushes me to explore both sides. And I have a great love of pop music, but I feel very strongly that what I have to offer as an artist is a unique perspective on that, you know? I think if you look at it the right way, it can be fun.
Wow.
Maybe, but then it's awful sometimes. You know, it is. I mean, it is really hard sometimes, of course, if you're really going for a vision. And people are there to essentially water that down, you know?
So how do you deal with that?
Well, you know, a lot of heated conversations, and you have to fight hard. You do. And I think we're just talking about Prince, and it's been very inspiring for me to go back into him as an artist and really be so reminded of how he never backed down on things, you know, and fought hard, but also was super smart and always listened. That's what Lenny always says, man. He's like, Prince would, you know, he would never not be listening to you. He would always be taking it in, you know, and he would always go away. He'd hang up when he'd be like, I'm not changing the record, you know, I'm not, you know. They thought they didn't have an urban song on Diamonds and Pearls, and he's like, I'm not, you work it out, you know. But then that night, he went back to the studio and he may get off, you know.
Right.
Wow. He just came in with it the next day and put it on the disc.
That's right. When we first spoke about Prince, you told me... your favorite record was Diamonds and Pearls.
Mm. Oh, I have so many, though. For You is probably one of my favorites, though. Right up there with it. That was
so you're really big on vocal arrangements and
that's what I'm saying. That's when I got the 8-track, started making, you know, arrangements with only voice.
You've probably mastered that. I know a lot of people that have used that device, the 8-track's machine.
And the loop pedals, yeah.
Yeah, but... you're probably the one person that I know that will find ways to push it into, okay. I don't want to say like it's the C word. I don't want to say commercial, but to at least make it more accessible, because I know that a lot of artists that use that are far on the left as far as experimenting is concerned.
But, right.
What drew you to that as your weapon of choice?
Yeah.
And
well, I think it all comes from feeling limitation. So I was doing gigs with just guitar when I first started playing in New Zealand at little bars. My dad would take me, you know, I was like 16, and so I couldn't get in. And then I felt I needed to express more color, you know, and get more across in the performances. So when I learned this little Boss, it was, you know, the Boss loop pedals, the classic ones. I never really read the manual, but just kind of...
All right, let me break it down just in case people don't know. Okay, so this device is...
It enables you to sing
with yourself. You can loop yourself.
Overdub yourself.
Okay, yeah. That's right. Yeah, you can put your instrument down altogether and just form a bed.
I think it was created for guitars first, and then people... Yeah. Started to sing into the device.
Yeah, that's right. I never used it with guitar, though. I only used it with vocals, and then eventually found that, my voice has a very different texture when it's layered and, you know, can sound like a different instrument. So I started putting down the guitar and becoming more fascinated with that as an instrument in of itself, you know?
So do you keep every performance fresh as, and do you have a go-to way for using those effects, or...
Well, here's a funny story for you. When you saw Jay Leno, okay, that was... I still refused to play to a click track at that point, okay? So usually when you're doing live television, you probably want to get the loop, like, synced so it doesn't completely fall out of time on the live television, but I was very stubborn. And we had to do it, like, 3 times, you know, because I was so nervous because my finger was shaking so much, I change it every time, you know? I start up the intro just kind of with a new loop each time to keep it fresh, because I don't want it to get too...
Stale.
Yeah, rehearsed, you know, too rehearsed, or feeling like, okay, here we go, she does this part, she does that part. I really thrived on the danger aspect. But, of course, live television is different, you know, and you've got a whole camera crew. And so from that point onward, I decided to start, you know, involving Ableton Live in the set, and we have aspects now that are a little more, locked in. But there's something to me that's very important with every live show, that there's room for collapse, you know, or at least the chance of collapse. But you do know what I'm talking about, because living on the edge of that tension is what's so...
Has it ever broken down on you in concert?
Of course. I mean, you know, and again, it's a chance for a very human moment, you know?
You can play it off.
Yeah, you know, we always can back it up if things fall out, and you ask the audience, can we do it again? And it's cool. I think always have to keep that there somehow.
Okay, so I want to know basic things about your life, musically related. What was your first concert?
It was a band called Silverchair.
Yeah, you guys, that's
amazing. Yeah,
Silverchair was big out here.
Oh, yeah.
They're not. Them boys,
well,
they
check it out. They're
like 30 now, right?
That's right. No, they were 14. They were 12. They were 14. They were a grunge rock band from Australia.
They were from Australia.
You probably don't know this about Silverchair, though. After they had their big blow up with the grunge band, they started making some very wild pop music. And Van Dyke Parks himself says that he puts Daniel Johns on the same level as Brian Wilson as a songwriter. Yes, he does. Now, check this out. The song we just played, Daniel Johns wrote that with me. We did that together on the piano. He plays the piano on the song on the record. Daniel Johns from Silverchair.
Wow.
Really?
Wow. Who'd have thought?
You got to get on the later records.
This actually reminds me of when I found out that dude from Spin Doctors worked with Bilal on his demo. That was kind of wild. That's crazy.
And Bilal is on the last album, too.
Yes, he is.
Yeah, it took Bilal like 10 minutes to really make me comprehend. I was like, wait, who produces? He goes, no, from Spin Doctors. I was like, no. Okay.
Wow.
Who produced this? No, Spin Doctors. And I was like, okay. Who produced it? I refuse to believe it. That's amazing. This is the second time that we've mentioned Van Dyke Parks. Like, how did your paths even cross? Because, I mean...
Yeah.
He's the god.
Oh, he's my fairy godfather. He is the sweetest... He really is like this ethereal, magical person in my life. Lenny is very close with Van Dyke, and I had said what a huge fan I was of the Silverchair record called Diorama, and Van Dyke arranged the strings for the whole album. Can you imagine this band that had become a huge, you know, success as a grunge, you know, garage rock band, and then they make a record that, I swear, these songs modulate like 10 times within each, you know, 5 minutes, and he gets Van Dyke to arrange all the strings on her, you know, he learns piano for the album. I just thought it was incredible.
Okay, what's the, now this is the educational portion of our radio show.
Diorama.
I'm writing it down right now.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, yeah. So I love
Van Dyke.
This
is exactly why I wanted this show, so I can learn and nerd out. So you're saying that Diorama was their left turn, their departure album?
Yeah, that's right. yeah, and you know, it didn't do so well in terms of commercially, you know. But
I have a theory now. Yeah. As a person that really doesn't know much about Silverchair,
yeah,
what was the album that came out before?
Oh, that would have been Neon Ballroom.
It was that their peak? Or? Love.
Yeah, I mean, it was soon after. The big one was, I don't know what the big one was in America. Frog Stomp, yeah, or, oh, wow. They were 14.
Yeah. Wow. It was what, like 94 or like, something like that? Yeah, I was in high school.
You know? Or maybe 16 or something. I don't know. But.
So they were massively large and, you know,
yeah,
these cute kids, mm-hmm, playing adult music.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a theory about what they call Departure Records, which, you know, I mean, you'll see it as like, oh, spiritual maturity and growing into the thing. And I guess, and it's not coming from a cynical place, but for every Departure album that there is, there's always the mountain or the shadow or the eclipse of an album or an image that they can't escape.
Wow.
And they will do anything, sometimes consciously and other times subconsciously. Like in the case of the Beastie Boys,
Paul's Boutique.
Making Paul's Boutique, they wanted to wash away the bratty frat boy image that Fight for Your Right was. In the case of There's a Ride Going On by Sly, you know, having just conquered Woodstock in 1969 and, you know, had 4 top 10 hits and finally, like, the dream was realized after, like, 3 album attempts to make them Sly and the Family Stone such a, you know, a household name. And then he kind of turns his back on everything. I mean, making an innovative funk record while doing it. But you know, Prince definitely, I'm reading this this manuscript, this book right now, of him actually planning Purple Rain and then also planning his exit strategy.
Wow.
With Around the World a Day.
Making Around the World a Day, even before the Purple Rain tour. And it's just,
he soared. He had a vision. It was the eclipse.
He knew he was going to get trapped into.
Wow.
So, okay. Oh, wow. So with that said, would you consider Phrenology to be the Roots Departure record?
You know what? I will probably say that now, maybe I'll take 25% credit of it being self-sabotage-y, as in not wanting to follow Things Fall Apart. But if I'm really, truly honest.
Tipping point?
No.
Because that really felt like the departure for me.
No, that was us being normal. That was us trying to be like ground zero normal, which I know with. My point is that I think with Phrenology, with what was happening with Neo Soul, like, I shot a Neo Soul Coke commercial.
Neo Soul Coke.
Oh, like,
half the calories of regular.
Like, only one of those commercials came out, but it was like, we did a 5-part commercial. It was like me, Amel, Angie Stone, Music Soul Child. Like, we were all playing, like, you know, categories, like, you know, like, we did the spot.
Wow.
It never came out. Only like one of them came out. It was like Aries, all the Neo Soul lights.
Wow. Neo Soul game night with Coke.
Yeah. It was like that. Like,
basically like real life.
No, but I mean, it there was a point where I felt like maybe. Okay, because of us not knowing that we were going to win the Grammy, and then Tariq wanted to shoot a movie, and I wanted to see Voodoo through the tour, like, we took 2000 off, which should have been the cash-in year, you know? And instead, we were like, okay, we'll come back January 2001 and do it all over again. And then it was just like, maybe we felt like our territorial pissing marks were getting violated. So it's sort of like, okay, well, we're gonna show y'all, we're gonna do everything but Neo Soul. But then everyone had that idea, because, you know, I mean, Stankonia and definitely Speaker Box had that that we're going to turn our back on this thing. Like, everybody was going contrary, including D'Angelo, like, you know, when we started Black Messiah, like, it was going to be way more radical, way more.
Wow.
Wow.
It, you know, in his mind, he wanted to do, like, Fishbones, give a monkey a brain. Give I can't pronounce that.
It's a really, really long title.
Yeah. Wow. You know, so I guess, I don't know. I mean, but it still worked for us. That's the thing, though. It still worked. So I feel like the tipping point wasn't our departure record, but it was just like, it was the album that I had the least, and I was just like, okay, what do I do? I'll take instructions.
Sometimes I look at making albums like an itch you need to scratch, you know? And when you said something about like the eclipse or the vision that something that's lingering in the subconscious that you need to kind of grab for after you've had a moment with a record or I don't know, there's something in the back of your mind that you're like, I need to get at this, I need to unveil this, something that's there, and whether that be a highly, you know, success, you don't know,
so do you
whether
feel
that's going
to
resonate.
Have, like, do you listen to someone and that gets you amped? Like last week, Common played me like 5 songs from his new record.
Wow.
And I was feeling some sort of, and I'm working on this record, so I'm feeling some sort of way like, yo, I got to come with it. Like, I really got to come with it. Like,
right.
So I'll say the first time in 10 years, I felt like, you know, I mean, when Dilla died, then I was just like, ugh, I don't want to do music no more. And only like one record a year, that sort of thing. So maybe between like 2006 and 2016, I had this dark law of not really wanting to put my heart into the record process.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just put all that passion in one record. Now I'm just like, I got to come with it. So, like, is there an artist that you hear that gets your juices flowing? And I don't mean like, I could do that.
Ooh.
I don't mean that way, but I mean like.
Oh, man, there's so many. I will say that, as we were talking about New Zealand before, there's some very special things that come out of New Zealand, and there's two brothers that I listen a lot to. Well, you know Unknown Mortal Orchestra, I'm sure.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So that's Ruben Nielsen, who I've known for years because he had a punk band when I was a kid.
Oh, wow.
And I used to go to his shows and sneak in underage and be front row. They were called the Mint Chicks. They were so raw. They were great. And the singer of the band, huh?
They were punk?
Yeah, super post-punk, kind of super screamy, but you know, great kind of melodic guitar lines, very angular rhythms. It was fantastic. And the lead singer of that band was Cody Nielsen, which is Ruben's brother. Now, he has his own side projects, his own records.
Silicon.
You know what?
That album is so good.
I can't stop listening to it. And, they just keep reinventing themselves, you know? I've seen not everyone knows their stories, but they just keep starting these projects. And to me, that's really inspiring. And when you say, like, I've got to come with it or kind of keep on that that new energy, I don't know, it's cool. It inspires me.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at Airbnb.com/host.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app. Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What was the first record you ever purchased?
Wow. You know what? One of the very first albums I ever bought with my own money was Frank by Amy Winehouse.
Oh, wow.
And we've talked about this before, and I told you what an important artist she was for me for those reasons. I listened to lots of other albums before then, but there was something very special about picking that up. I didn't know anything about her. I was like, she just looks sick on the front cover. And
wait, you just did it based on the album cover?
Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything.
You didn't hear anything?
I listened to it in the record store, but I picked it up because, you know, when you, I loved that. I missed that. Putting the CD on, and I listened to it, and I thought, this sounds great. Because she was a guitarist, too, and she was playing these jazz inversions that I was learning. But she had beats, and that's what I always felt was, you know, I wanted to explore. I want to get tougher with my sound. I don't want to be a safe songwriter, you know, just keep it all pretty. And I wanted it to have, you know, like some balls. And she was, man, she just took me to school, you know, and all of these singers. And it's so funny, man, how the world connects people. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it is. So... I'm just like, how do you know about beats, though? I mean, like, the average. I'm just saying, I'm trying not to be cultural elitist or sexist or any of these things, but normally there is an older figure trickle-down person. Like, yeah. I'm the youngest people of people in my brood, so yeah. This was handed down. I mean, yeah. What about you guys? Like, were you...
I had an older sister who was really into music. She's the one that got me into hip hop. She's the one that pretty much put me in.
Yeah, triple down.
Into Prince. Yeah, yeah.
Where did you fall, William? Bill?
I was into jazz, and I had really great teachers in high school. And then I went to Africa when I was in college, and that sort of
blew my mind a lot.
I love how the white people.
I'm about to say.
You ever been to Africa?
Nah.
So I'm the only one in this room that hasn't been.
I mean, I've been to South Africa, but that
doesn't count.
You know, yeah.
That's not real Africa?
Apparently not.
Yeah, I mean, from you talk to people from the continent, they say that that's like the most westernized country.
I love when Fonte's PC, man. It's so
it's the most westernized.
You're thinking really hard right now.
So I didn't go to real Africa yet.
I'm just saying.
No, but it does bring to mind, actually, when we're talking about being young and what was inspiring. I loved musical theater. And I was, this makes me sound like, I was a musical theater kid. But I was really drawn to the. Well, there's such a connotation with that.
Fonte, your head's down.
Oh, no, I'm just listening.
Oh, you weren't in musical theater?
Hell no.
That's what I'm talking about. That's what I mean.
It wasn't.
You say hell, like H-E-A-L.
No,
nah,
man.
I tried. I gave it a shot.
Okay, so we have three theater kids in here. Four.
I did a couple plays.
Four.
In high school.
I knew it.
Yo, you know what? Matter of fact, I did hair in high school. I did hair. I didn't like musicals, but I was in the musical. I forgot about that. I did hair in high school.
I did like school Christmas plays and stuff like that.
Yeah, I was about to say, everyone in this room needs to stop lying. I know y'all was involved with musical
theater.
Yeah,
I did hair.
I was Black Santa, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you have the beard back then?
No, I was like 13 at the time. But I was Black Santa in a really white school in Indiana. So
Oh, of all the places.
Hey, right. Wow, I was right.
They was
right.
Hanging in Indiana.
Yeah, like I was about to say, that's probably.
Wait, did you think about the Hazy Shade of Criminal album cover?
That's criminal.
Okay, wait, we're getting off the chain. Yeah, okay. Off the roof.
No.
Okay.
Never.
Yeah, so I think some of the melodic interest might have come from a love of that. But when you're talking about beats, I know what you mean. I'm trying to think. I loved Jurassic 5 when I was in high school. I listened to them a lot. You know, there were certain acts that got me thinking, why does this make my body move like this? And I started to write vocal lines that were percussive. You know, I wanted to find the bits between to sing in. So maybe that's...
I'm now seeing the Jurassic 5
effect. What happened to Jurassic 5?
Wait, I'm going to tell you something funny.
I love them, too. They were great.
So imagine it being like 1999. 98, 99, right? And so, okay, I'm in my agent's office, and we got an offer. And, okay, I don't mean this no sort of way. Just understand the logistics of the situation. She's saying that, okay, you guys are going to open for Jurassic 5 and Black Eyed Peas. And we started laughing. We was like, wait, what? He said, yeah, you guys are going to open. I was like, open? You don't open for the... Now, it was 99. This is before Fergie came to Peas. And Jurassic 5 was like the quintessential underground group. Groups that were normally open for the Roots.
Right.
Who at this time were in their platinum powers or whatever. But the thing was, is that hip-hop so rarely came down under to Australia and to New Zealand that whoever just went over there...
You was the man.
And did 5 days. If you did Big Day Out, the big festival over there.
Yeah, represent.
Then... Suddenly, you became... So, there was like an inside joke that like, yo, Jurassic 5 can play stadiums in Australia.
They probably...
We're like, get the fuck out of here.
They probably could.
It's like, whoa. Black Eyed Peas have an audience of 10,000 in Australia. You're like, get out. Ben Harper can play stadiums. Like, so all the acts that... I mean, it was the trick that the Roots used to play. Like, we would go to places that no one else would go and then conquer. So I always wondered, I was going to ask, what was the Jurassic 5 effect on, they were like the Beatles over there, because no one else would go over there.
That's right. Well, New Zealand's interesting. We're talking about the differences, but R&B and soul is very important in New Zealand. More important, I'd say, and it's funny, because of course you have Hiatus Kaiyote and these incredible R&B acts coming out of Australia, but it's more of a rock thing, you know, with a lot of the music when you're growing up. New Zealand, the Māori people are very like, amazing rhythmic music, very melodic, very soulful, you know. They play in churches, they have the marae. So hip-hop's very big in New Zealand. Hip-hop's really big, and soul artists, and yeah, I remember these artists were headlining huge venues, you know? They were big. And, you know, when you live so far away, I mean, from New York, it probably takes me 22 hours to get home or something insane, you know? You're so curious about music from other parts of the world. It becomes it becomes a little obsession, you know? I found something on, I was around at the start of blogs and everything, obviously, and your friend starts telling you about this thing, you know? And then you take a little rabbit hole with that, and you're so far from it that it's so exotic and exciting.
So have you, coming back to Australia, I mean, after your Grammy success or whatever, like, was it the, like, have you had a homecoming welcome as far as...
To New Zealand, right?
Yes, to New Zealand.
Yeah. You know, it's a big deal, you know? It's a big deal for a country so small when artists get recognized in America, same for Australia, but especially for New Zealand because, yeah, like I said, there's only 4 million people there, you know? Wow. So it is a real trip when we are able to connect and on a sort of global level. So,
are you able to go home and still, like, be regular? Can you go to the grocery store? Or,
in Hamilton?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's different. Yeah, it's definitely different. I lay pretty low. Like, I'm all about getting back to nature when I'm there. You know,
back
get
to
the ocean.
And
I didn't have a farm in New Zealand. I didn't grow up on a farm. I only had a farm in L.A.
Oh, yeah, L.A.
I'll still never understand that. Steve.
Steve hasn't said shit all night.
I know.
He just moved. He's
just one thing. Now he's standby. Okay, wait. Hang on. What are your plans for the future?
Ooh. That old question.
I sound like Barry White.
Yeah.
So what are your plans?
Well, like I said, I'm writing more than I've ever written, which is exciting. And I'm excited to start sharing some of that. So putting new music out, maybe even before the album. And then I start the album, pretty soon, man. I reckon next month I'm going to start getting into production. Writing. More writing, New York. I'm doing a lot of improvised collaborations. The stuff you came to, the Space Jam and this new improvisation collective called Exotech.
Tell us about Exotech.
Yeah, quick. Man. It's kind of, the name kind of came from an interest in like exotica music and kind of Brazilian rhythms and also technology, you know, using gadgets and crazy loopers and industrial sounds, you know. It's like 14 people in the core ensemble.
How do you
perform.
Coach them?
It's
How do you
insane.
Keep people from overplaying?
Well, this is the fascinating thing about it. is when everyone's tuned in and you're kind of aware of how many people are on stage. Of course, it's very easy for it to become lasagna, you know? It's just layers and layers. But some very special things that happen when you're conscious of that. So everyone is listening intently to each other.
So everybody just plays something, and then you take the tapes afterwards, and then...
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And then we evolve and develop the ideas. We perform on the rounds. Everyone in the audience is quite intimately involved. There's a bit of conducting, a bit of head nods, a bit of hand signals for things, but essentially it's just sort of just going into the unknown, you know? And it's very liberating. It's very liberating for someone who spends a lot of time in studio like I do and, you know, being very intentional about my recordings and production. This is a time for me to just get back in that space of pure expression, improvisation. It's great.
That's cool. A good thing. Oh, boy. How was your day today? No, those are questions. No, I'm talking to you. Give her a look at like, or he ain't talking to you. Actually bent backwards like it was.
Yeah. Okay. My day was good.
Like it was bullets from the Matrix.
No. There's a lot of people in this room. Yeah. So with that collective Exotech, which is Sophia Bruce, who you just heard.
Right.
This is our kind of joint little improvisation group, and we're starting a Red Bull in artist residency, where we're developing these songs, to be kind of releasable, or at least just kind of developing them from the improvised context, which has always been interesting to me, because live music is such a particular thing. The process from taking live jams, David Byrne's very interesting with this, of course, you mm-hmm. know, because so many of the Talking Heads records were kind of developed and from live, well, so many records are.
Yeah, jams.
Gosh, well, of course.
A lot of people.
Yeah, but I've just been watching his documentary, The Stop Making Sense one, and that's kind of what we're exploring for this in-artist residency at Red Bull, and I've been spending a lot of time preparing lyrics for this and kind of getting in a zone of... Yeah, taking them from the stage to the studio.
See, I don't know if you know this by design or if you're just doing this organically, but, you know, I always felt, you know, the idea of community, which is something that record labels kind of discourage.
Yeah.
They'd rather deal with an artist one-on-one and not deal with groups or multiple families of groups and that sort of thing, because they're harder to control.
But of course.
Yeah, I always felt that the best music movements and the most successful music comes from crews and people. If you look at Motown, you know, they were a crew.
And yourself, man.
Native Tongues, yeah, with De La Tribe. Yeah. And,
no,
you know,
of course.
Prince Powerful. Grew his own crops.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
P-Funk,
is that...
Yeah, P-Funk, they did it too. Yeah.
So is that your end game to gather a community of people and cultivate them and create this music? And
I encourage it wherever I can. You know, I think I've been very blessed to kind of magnetize the right people wherever I move, and by I mean the right, like just the open people that are down to jam, and it always ends up being something that's a sound, you know, like something that comes to inform the music. And I work alone, you know, I'm not a band. It's I make these songs in my bedroom, and then I bring in people when I hit walls, you know. And so even the band that you heard when we played Leno, like, they've become very close collaborators of mine now, because I kind of hit these moments where I reach the limitations of my own skills, you know. And at that point, I really like to play on that as much as possible. Be like, who can I draw from? Who I can? It's like being a painter, you know. And you have this palette all around you all the time. And I'm inspired by the same people you said that weren't afraid to be like, all right, you know, where does this need to go? Who have I got that I know can help me take this even further?
But you also seem very nomadish or gypsy-ish.
Yeah.
I mean, just constantly moving. Yeah. And so how do you, like, when will you leave New York once all of your resources are dried?
Seasons, you know. The farm time was kind of, there was a period where I was very isolated there, and I didn't leave much, you know. I just stayed inside and did, that's right. That's right. Thank you, Steve.
Sugar Steve, sound effects Steve.
Well, because the kitchen was outside as well, so I cooked like outside, but then it was just the bedroom and the bed inside. So it was strange.
No wonder you are animals.
Yeah. It was weird. But then there would be these seasons where I did like Space Jam. I started Space Jam in L.A., okay? It was every Sunday night. I put it on Twitter.
You were allowed
to
call it Space Jam?
I called it Space Jam. I thought it was fun.
Like McDowell's, like, nobody shamed you. Nobody from Warner Brothers like, wait a minute, child.
I didn't tell Warner Brothers. You know, I just wanted to do this for fun. I was doing a tour with Janelle Monáe in Australia and New Zealand, and it got canceled because she got very sick. And I came back to America, and I was just restless. You know, we were just about to do a tour, and so I thought, well, I'm here. Let's do something. And you know, Thundercat did it most weeks. Miguel came down and jammed with me. This is like, these are big guys that, you know, don't have to do that, but they would just get up and just go into the unknown with me. It was very powerful. And
you were doing it in New York for a while. Like, are you going to bring it back?
I'm kind of focused on the Exotech thing for a bit now, but I like the idea of bringing Space Jam back in cities and on the road, if we're all feeling up for it, going to a little venue nearby and in the spirit of the people we mentioned, continuing that conversation. So there's seasons of being very engaged with community and seasons where I really withdraw.
Now, should you leave New York, do you have any other fantasy destinations that you would, you know, would you go to Europe next, see what's up in
London?
Well,
check this out. No, I just got back from London. I was there like a couple of weeks ago. But Japan, I've never been to Japan.
Wow.
Never.
Wait, even as a professional artist?
Never.
Wait, you have a Grammy.
Two.
Now Japan has gotten.
I've never.
She shot me down like Beatrice in Kill Bill. Like,
and I've never been
to
Japan,
motherfucker.
I've never been to Japan.
Oh man.
Now Japan has been kind of tough lately. I think like over for the past couple years.
Why is other Bill laughing at the punchline before?
Because it was just like, here comes some old man wisdom about Japan. Here I go.
Get the fuck out of my way. It's been real. No, it's kidding because like they had the earthquake. It was the tsunami. They had like a natural disaster, and then you know it was that, and that like fucked shit up for real over there. Because we were trying to get over there for a minute back in like it was like.
You had to go too.
I've been once in 2004. It was not a really good experience with the time. I didn't like it.
What?
Nah, I didn't like
There's
it.
There's a story there.
What? Oh, man, it's always a story, bro. So I went to Japan.
I've never met an African-American male the PC title
right.
that didn't love Japan.
We went over there. And we went over there. We was over there under some false pretenses, for one.
And little brother, too?
This is little brother. Yeah, this is LB. This is 2004. Wow. So we went over there, man. And I remember the first night we got out there, we was just out walking around. And we was trying to go to a strip club.
Yes.
And forever, I'm not really the strip club dude like that. Because strip clubs are about pageantry. And I think just like a lot of, you know, it's a lot of that. And I'm not really into that. I'm not into the seeing the tricks and all that stuff.
You're from North Carolina.
I know, but that's another story because it was a strip club we had called 14K. But I'm sure you know, it was legendary. But yes. I'm not going to get into that right now because that's not what we're talking about.
Oh, we're raising families.
Man,
I love you, honey.
That was
before I became
washed in the blood of Jesus. So Japan, we was trying to go to the joint, and so we walk up to the door, and as soon as we get to the door, little dude comes out. No, Japanese only. Wouldn't even let us in. We was like, oh, word?
Oh.
So, like, that right there was just kind of, I was like, fuck this fucking place.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
On the first day?
Dude, I swear to God.
First day.
So we left, and I think we ended up eating, like, McDonald's for the rest of the fucking day. And then the rest of the time we were there, we did get some Kobe beef, though. We went to Kobe, and we had some Kobe beef. And, like, I saw one black guy in the train. We hugged each other. We were just so happy. I've never been so happy to see another black man in my life.
You serious?
I'm dead ass, man. I ain't making none of this shit up. But, we hugged each other. It was a very Sankofa moment. The crowds are very different. So they're not really like a big making a lot of noise. They just really watch you.
Very polite.
But after the show, I mean, they love you and they go crazy. It up.
Yes.
But I haven't been since 2004, and I'm really not in a rush back to go. But I hope you go, and I'm sure you'll kill it.
I'm actually kind of weirded out by
that. Yo, Fonte, man, I got to make this right, man.
Yeah, you do. Because, no, Amir, he's, wow. You
I might
you have
to,
some...
like, of Tokyo, road despite trip. The fact, no, road despite trip. The fact that
let's go.
Their largest shoe size West is size 10, and you know their jean size is 34. I mean, Tokyo is my third favorite place on earth.
Wow,
wow.
What's you're the first two?
If I had to leave the tri-state area to live somewhere else, number one is Portland, Oregon.
What?
Mm-hmm. Number two is Austin, Texas.
Okay.
Number three is Tokyo. Mm. Number four is the Bay Area. Well, hopefully I can afford it.
I'm about to say.
If I can afford it, I can't afford it on my salary. Number,
if you can't afford it, then we in the goddamn project.
Number five.
I'm in a cardboard box. Yeah, we're like camping out in your
number, number five is London. But
wow. The fact that you've actually thought about that, though, that's very, that you've plotted it out. Yeah. That much, that's crazy.
Portland has probably the best used record store shopping, the best quality records for cheap. Like, when they see me, they won't charge me $500 for a Galt McDermott record. I walk into a Connecticut spot, then suddenly, you're like, oh, this is $9,000.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, they don't know the true value of, like, that stuff I really love. There's more strip clubs per capita in Portland.
And I've never been to one. Every time I go, I'm in and out.
Nike headquarters.
Yeah, been there. Been there.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you have good record shopping, great strip clubs, and...
That's it.
Don't take much.
And the food capital, I mean, the food truck capital of the United States, to me, is Portland.
Yeah, that's true. I'm knowing more orchestra in Portland now. I mean, he's from New Zealand, but he works out of Portland now.
Smart man. Smart man. That's smart right. man. Well, Kimbra, I really, truly appreciate you for taking your time out of your busy schedule.
It's not as busy as yours.
Well, no. It's...
You are insane, though.
No, we're not going to...
We're not going to... Okay, but...
Yeah, Amir
I think we should start. Go ahead, Kimbra. Go in. Go and tell them.
How many projects you have going on right now?
I took a 4-day vacation last week.
Where did you go?
I did nothing in Los Angeles for 4 days.
You didn't answer my text messages?
I did.
Yeah, I said except to answer my text
messages. Yeah, I did. Okay, yeah. I stayed in bed, and it was the worst feeling ever, man. Yeah. To not do anything.
I can't do that.
The only thing I did was I figured out how to get rid of 10 gigs of music I didn't need my DJ computer. Like, that was the only work I did.
You actually should do that for me, because I cannot do that. That's
Figure out which one's the kill. You can't figure out.
No, you got it. You only need everything. One. Don't stop till you get enough. You don't need 17. So, like, I'm literally going
have, like,
through.
I'll have to have like all the different edits, not necessarily like this.
No, I'll keep the individual edits. But I had like four Jay-Z Hard Knock Life.
Okay,
4 billion of them that I didn't need. So, yeah, I mean, cleaning out my hard drives is my favorite pastime. But no, I took a 4-day vacation and I hated I didn't hate it, but it was just.
You need to be doing things.
Do you ever sleep so much that you get tired from sleeping?
Yes. Yeah. Definitely.
I got trapped in that cycle.
That's a true thing.
And then I was like, oh, this is what depression feels like. So let me get out of this.
When you're on vacation, you're supposed to go out. Stuff that you
because otherwise, it becomes like social isolation. Like that's
that's why I DJ so much. Like I'm not a let's go to the bar.
Well, you know,
I'll DJ in the bar, and then you know
take
that's
a
me going
record
out
shopping. You know that kind of thing.
I now record shop for other people. Like my new shit is now.
Wait,
taking
what am I doing?
I told you record shopping before.
No. I'm saying I record shop for you.
Well, no. I like my thing now is whenever the kids or the parents.
Oh, okay, I got you.
Like, you know, some 8-year-old will be like, yo, my kid's in the Pet Sounds.
Like when you do the
then I'll
playlist.
Be like, let's go to Amoeba, and then I'll buy them.
Right. That's okay. Nice. Okay.
Like
cool.
1,000 records. Like yeah. I've started at least 30 record collections.
Gotcha. Wow.
Because, I mean, I'm not doing it to be all noble.
Cause it's like, just...
No, I'm just addicted to going to a record shop
are,
and
yes.
shopping.
Yeah.
And
you are, yeah.
I'm not going to buy, another Led Zeppelin 3 record.
The Questlove Scholarship Foundation. For all musical youth.
Look, can we get out of this, guys, please? Yes. Kimber, to answer your question,
you take vacation.
I took a 4-day vacation. In the future, I'm going to take another 7 days off. I'm going to get on a train and hobo it.
I actually want to do that because you keep talking about taking a train.
It's my favorite thing on earth.
Or just taking a train, like cross country or whatever?
I'm literally, I got a, well, the best travel is in Canada. So I'm going
to. You should go to New Zealand. Take a train through New Zealand.
Initially, I was going to go to India, but I can't. To travel there and then to do the 4-day trek and then to come back, I'd get
like
fired.
A week and a half. Yeah.
Yeah, I would need three weeks to really recover. Yeah. But I plan on going from New York to San Fran, then Vancouver, back to New York.
Nice.
Vancouver to New York. You can rent your own car, have old timey.
Oh, wow.
You know,
and I'll make
I get to imagine what travel was like in the 40s without being discriminated.
Travel like the 40s, minus that whole Jim Crow thing.
Why are we trying to, like, our best laughs here is like at the expense of racism.
Everyone, every time.
Is every racism joke. That hilarious?
It is.
This
it
room.
It is.
I have to keep from crying.
Don't talk, Steve.
We covered so much.
Yes, we did. Okay. Okay, so with that said, Kimber, once again, we thank you very much for gracing us with your presence and your music. And your artistry and your stories and your journey. Give it up, ladies and gentlemen, for Kimber Lee Johnson.
Yes, sir.
Kimber Lee.
It sounds like you're saying Kimberly.
Oh, it is. Is it Kimbra
Lee?
I know it's Kimbra.
Yeah, it sounded like you were saying
well,
Kimberly.
Were your parents trying to do Kimberly?
No, they weren't.
Okay. I think they were trying to do Kimberly.
No, they weren't.
Okay.
Essence Fest 2018.
BET.
Yo. BET Awards celebrates black music with Kimberly Johnson.
Your white voice
is on
point.
It's going to be lit. It's going to be lit.
This just feels like that moment this feels like that moment in Zoolander before Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go where he's like, I don't think you thought that I thought you thought that I was referencing. Yes, I know it's Kimbra Lee Johnson. It's more authentic that way. Not Kimberly. But I think your parents were trying to name you Kimberly and just didn't know that. You know, it could have been one name. All right. Well,
we like it. It's two, though. We like it. It's good. It's got a nice ring to it.
Yes. Well, Kimbra Lee Johnson, we thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app. Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken, Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two, Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.